Look around, make sure there's not any people. I was going halfway through the sermon this morning, and I realized some old friends were sitting right there. I hadn't noticed. It was embarrassing. So I got to look around to see who's here before I surprise myself again. Ben mentioned, I don't know if you all got it, if we're here in time to hear him say at the beginning, that the music set we sang were songs that come chosen by junior high students when they have their worship times together, and Ben and others on this team up here are working with our young people. In fact, everyone in the music leadership, worship leadership group this morning are themselves leaders of this church to their own generation, to their peers, and also have turned to the folks younger than them and are involved in some kind of ministry with students. And they chose to allow us to experience the kind of music and music choices that some of our young people make, and I want to thank them for that. And we are going to end this morning with a reflection on the importance of training the next generation, of realizing that God finally encourages us by giving us a chance to pass on what we know so that those who are going to step into the places of service can be made strong to do so. And it's a privilege to be part of that. And I want to thank our worship leaders this morning for their leadership this morning. There is a succinct description of the Christian life that's given in 2 Corinthians 5:7. Simply this: we walk by faith, not by sight. It's a great way to think of what it means to be a Christian. We're making our way through life. We're going somewhere. We're walking. But we walk by faith, trusting in what is unseen rather than sight, measuring our lives and determining our worth and making our choices based on circumstances and the reinforcement of the world and the things that we can always see and determine and predict. Now, most of us would prefer to walk by sight, I think. It's true that it would be nice if clear direction signs were given and doors opened at just the right moment and words of encouragement were there ready at hand when we need them. We prefer that to having to trust an unseen God. But if He were not hidden from us at times, if He didn't make Himself obscure at times, we would never learn to have faith. There's a definition of the word faith given in the book of Hebrews. It said it is the conviction of things we cannot see. And it's required, therefore, that at times God be hidden, His purposes unclear, and for us to trust Him nonetheless in order to become men and women of faith. And there's the text we have to consider this morning in Acts chapter 18 is going to have a lot of the faith-producing hiddenness of God to begin with. And then we'll see the ways of God in encouraging His servant. So if you turn to Acts 18, I want to begin reading there. This has been we're in a series of studies on the book of Acts. There's one more next week that will conclude this section before we take a break and come back to these studies in the fall. And we are also at the end of what is called the second missionary journey. The city of Corinth, which we're about to enter along with the Apostle Paul as we read it this morning, is the last stop, effectively the last stop on the second missionary journey. And so we're near the end of these things, but this is one of the important, decisive, interesting, faith-building texts along the way. Let me begin at verse 1. After these things, he, that is Paul, left Athens and went to Corinth. And he found a Jew named Aquila, a native of Pontus, having recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius, the emperor, had commanded all the Jews to leave Rome. He came to them, and because he was of the same trade, he stayed with them, and they were working, for by trade they were tent makers. And he was reasoning in the synagogue every Sabbath, trying to persuade Jews and Greeks. Let me stop there. Now, the first verse, the first short sentence, is very understated in Acts. He left Athens and went to Corinth. But we know from other evidence elsewhere in the New Testament, from Paul's own writings, and from the history that leads up to this, that our imaginations will not, from this simple phrase, allow us to see what happened on this journey. I want to ask you to picture this man at this time as clearly as you can, because I think his discouragement really will help us see how God meets the needs of those in situations like that. The Apostle Paul, to be sure, had known the love of Christ for him and didn't waver in his certainty of it. He had been able to express the love of Christ to others and was consistent in his ability to offer the gospel to other people. He had experienced miracles in his own life, we know. But we also know that there was an accumulation of negative, hurtful rejection that had built up over the months that he had been on this journey, traveling with his friends, doing ministry. Perhaps in some ways the most difficult was the ridicule and rejection of the city of Athens, where he had just left. And all of this had come together to weigh upon him, and we see that, I think, and can imagine that to be the case as we watch Paul travel from Corinth to from Athens to Corinth. The journey is about 50 miles. Since he was not a rich man, he was certainly making the journey by foot, walking from one city to the next. We know that he had exited four successive cities under duress, beaten, dismissed, harassed, and ridiculed. He was almost certainly alone as he traveled from Athens to Corinth. Now you may remember when he was sort of run out of Berea and went to Athens, he left words for his friends to join him as soon as possible, but they never came to him in Athens. And we have in the letter to the first letter to the Thessalonians and in other documents references to correspondence between them. And evidently Paul had realized that there were problems at Thessalonica, maybe in Philippi. He sent Timothy, instead of calling for Timothy to come to him, he sent him back to Thessalonica to care for the church there. Silas may well have gone on to Philippi. His friends didn't join him quickly. He began and ended his time in Athens by himself, and now he's moving on to the next place. So he has had difficult experience one after the other. He is alone. And he's almost certainly broke as well at this point. We know that because when he gets to Corinth, Luke breaks the characteristic pattern in Acts. On entry to a new city, in all of the reporting up to this point, the first thing Luke tells us is how they began to do ministry. They went out to the riverside where they supposed there would be a place of prayer. They went into the synagogue and began to teach. They went to some place and began to do ministry. That's the first thing Luke tells us in every other setting. But here, when he enters Corinth, he gets a job. The first thing he does is gets a job and finds a place to stay. And I think the indication is that he was out of money. And it may even be that as he's traveling along this road, he's hungry. Does he have enough money to feed himself? What sort of shelter could he find as he walked these 50 plus miles? How many days would it have taken him? Did he walk? I think we ought to imagine him walking slowly and with his shoulders stooped and discouraged at heart and lonely and broke and going on to the next place. We don't know all of the patterns of funding of missionaries in the first century. We do know for sure that churches gave gifts to support those who did the work of the gospel. But at times the gifts were not forthcoming. They hadn't arrived. There was none and Paul is in that place, and the first thing he needs to do when he gets to town is get a job to support himself. The last thing we know, last thing to consider about this trip from Athens to Corinth is what Paul was anticipating he would find in the city of Corinth itself. It was a daunting place to go if you had strong faith in God and a concern for righteousness. It was an unrighteous place. It was the most morally depraved and unpredictable of the cities of its day. It had an empire, empire-wide, that is a reputation throughout the Roman Empire for loose living. There was if you wanted to sort of insult someone as being out of control sexually and debauched in general, you would say they were Corinthian in their behavior. That was a common way to describe such a person. And in the dramas, the popular dramas of the first century, if a Corinthian character showed up in the drama, he was inevitably drunk. That's the kind of place it was. That's the kind of reputation it had. Paul knew where he was going, and surely that would have daunted him as well. It was a trading city with multiple cultures, sanctioned prostitution, a center of trade in which deals, big deals could be done, fortunes could be made and then lost. It was a place of risks and rewards and shady characters to beware of, a place brimming with pride. And in all of these things, adding them together, his history of rejection in city after city, his loneliness, his poverty, and the regard he had for the place he was now going, we know the man was discouraged because he tells us so. In the first letter to the Corinthians, this is how Paul describes himself on this trip to this new city. When I came to you, brethren, I did not come with superiority of speech or of wisdom, proclaiming to you the testimony of God. For I determined to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and Him crucified. I was with you in weakness and in fear and in much trembling. That's who he was as he came to this new place. Afraid, trembling, weak, burdened, alone and broke. but he went anyway. He didn't stop. He didn't hope someone else would do it. He didn't give up his calling. He would take up his own later description and walk by faith, not by sight. He went into the place not knowing what would happen to him there, but assuming that God would take care of him. He went to the place without any assurance ahead of time of how God would meet his needs, only the assurance that he would do so, that the unseen God would be there and would protect him. And that's our what we want to learn from this morning. How does the Lord take care of His servant? What does God do to care for this man who is at a low place in his life? And then secondly, as I said before, we want to talk about new generations of leadership being put into place, the teaching ministry that will develop in Corinth so that we see new folks taking up the call to serve the Lord and serve the gospel and teach the truth and go where it was unnamed. Now, there is a controversy, let me just say this in passing, about what Paul means in 1 Corinthians when he said, I determined to know nothing among you except Christ and Him crucified. There are some interpreters that look back at the Athens ministry and said Paul regretted that he had used the language of pagans to share the gospel. Remember we said last week he quoted pagan poets and he acknowledged the philosophers of the day, and he interacted with them, and he spoke in their language, and he preached Christ using familiar terms to them. And there are some interpreters that said, yeah, that was a big mistake. What I should have done is just open the Bible and teach the Bible and preach the cross. I shouldn't try to engage the foreign culture. And that he's now regretting that, and that's what he means here. I don't think that's accurate at all. I think not at all a good way to understand what he's saying. The better interpretation seems to me is that he was just so weighed down himself is that he realized the only thing he had to cling to for himself, to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and Him crucified. Clinging to the cross himself, that would form the basis of his ministry because he himself was so depleted, I think is the better understanding. But in any case, let's move on now and hear how the Lord ministers to those in times like this. Verse 5. I want to read the rest of it and then we'll consider it together. But when Silas and Timothy had come down from Macedonia, Paul began devoting himself completely to the word, solemnly testifying to the Jews that Jesus was the Christ. By the way, I think the point there, it doesn't say it exactly, but we know from the letters that they came, when Silas and Timothy came, they brought some money with them. They had collected some money in Thessalonica and probably in Philippi as well. And when they came, they brought money. And so Paul, who had had a job for some weeks, maybe months now, was able to give up his tent-making job. And because there were funds, he was now able to teach full-time. Verse 6, But when the Jews resisted and blasphemed, he shook out his garments and said to them, "Your blood be on your own heads, I am clean. From now on I will go to the Gentiles." He left there and went to the house of a man named Titius Justus, a worshiper of God, whose house was next to the synagogue. Crispus, the leader of the synagogue, believed in the Lord with all his household, and many Corinthians, when they heard, were believing and being baptized. And the Lord said to Paul in a vision of in the night by a vision, "Do not be afraid any longer. Go on speaking and do not be silent, for I am with you, and no man will attack you in order to harm you. I have many people in this city." And he settled there for a year and 6 months, teaching the word of God among them. But while Gallio was proconsul of Achaia, the Jews with one accord rose up against Paul and brought him before the judgment seat, saying, "This man persuades men to worship God contrary to the law." But when Paul was about to open his mouth, Gallio said to the Jews, "If it were a matter of a wrong or vicious crime, O Jews, it would be reasonable for me to put up with you. But if these are questions about words and names and your own law, look after it yourselves. I'm unwilling to be judge of these matters." And he drove them away from the judgment seat. And they all took hold of Sosthenes, the new leader of the synagogue, since Crispus had converted. They all took hold of Sosthenes, the leader of the synagogue, and began beating him in front of the judgment seat. He'd done a bad job of prosecuting the case, and so his friends were ticked and beat him up. But Gallio was not concerned about any of these things. Now, the reference to Gallio's unconcern there sounds a bit as if he's harsh and distant and cold. We know from other references to Gallio in Roman history is that he was a very good man. He was a generous, kind-hearted, thoughtful man. And probably the reference here is not that he was cold and distant, but that he was fair-minded. That he didn't take sides easily. He was unconcerned, meaning he didn't do deals and pervert justice by taking sides. He was a good judge, an honorable judge, a judge that didn't have an axe to grind. So that's the events that took place in Corinth. And our question is, how is God meeting the needs of his friend? How is the Lord Jesus meeting the needs of his friend? How is he caring for his servant? What evidence do we have here to learn from about how God cares for people when they're discouraged? Well, I think the first thing that we should attend to is the role of the body of Christ, how God uses other believers to care for those who have needs and discouragements. There are two pairs of folks that come to Paul's aid in this story. The first are new friends to him, Aquila and Priscilla. The second are old friends to him, Silas and Timothy. And in both cases, the Lord shows up in the living presence of another person and extends care to the man who is discouraged and being faithful while at the same time struggling to do so. Aquila and Priscilla are very interesting people. They're met in the story of the New Testament for the first time here. They show up other places later. They will show up later in Acts. They go on to have a powerful ministry in Ephesus, later again in Rome. They are referenced in a couple of the letters, especially the book of Romans, in which Paul praises them for their godliness and service to the Lord and friendship to Him. They're a wonderful example of a couple doing ministry together for centuries, generations, Christian husbands and wives who want to serve the Lord together and want to have a ministry in common with one another have taken inspiration from Aquila and Priscilla. They always show up together. They travel together, they teach together, they open their home together, they do ministry together, and they're a wonderful example of that. They're mysterious, however, in that we know a good bit about them, but a key piece of information is not known to us. We know that they were Jews because they were run out of Rome when the Jews were forced out by Claudius the emperor. We know that they were tent makers by trade because Paul meets them in the tent making region of the city. He went there for a job, remember. And he's looking for work and he finds a booth where these two are working and he offers to help and they offer to pay him or something like that. He begins to work with them. They have the same trade. They are Christians, we know, at some point, but what we don't know is how they became Christians. It's not clear whether Paul met them and led them to Christ shortly after meeting them, or whether they were already believers when he met them, and they invited him into their home. I think the latter is the case. I think they were already Christians when they left Rome, but scholars debate the point. It's not clear when they came to Christ. But what we do know is that they cared for this man. And they were a powerful ministering presence from God in Paul's life. Think about the gift of new friends to you. When you, especially in your Christian walk, when you've had the experience maybe of going to a new city or to a new school or into a new ministry environment or something, and you meet people for the first time, you've never known them before, and you find your hearts knit together, and you find that they love the same Christ that you love, and they have a wonderful way of expressing it, and they have a sense of humor that just kind of clicks with yours, and in this case, they even had the same trade. They could have told leather working jokes, you know, if they, the old story about whatever. You know, the goat skin jokes that they would all know because they had the same trade. New friends are a great gift from God, aren't they? And there's some really good things about finding a new and beautiful expression of love for each other and love for the Lord together. One of the good things about new friends is they don't know all your old stuff. You can just be who you are today. You don't have to account for all the failure and foolishness of your past because they don't know it. They'll just let you be who you are starting today. They don't know your old ruts. You can sort of get out of patterns that aren't too healthy at times because they have no expectations that you're stuck in them. And it may well be that there's a freshness and newness that comes with new friendships because a lot of the stickiness and struggles of the past don't have to take place. They don't know your dreams or your sorrows. You can dream new dreams sometimes with new people. And all of these that's a great gift from God to let us sometimes be in a new place, flowering for the first time in a new relationship. And I think that's exactly what took place here. New friends are a great gift. And in addition, let me just observe for you, and importantly, I think, that they lived together. Aquila and Priscilla invited Paul into their home. And they worked together. They were in the common workplace, in the leather working region of the city, the center of commerce in the city where folks would come to buy tents or buy whatever it was that was made of leather, and they would be haggling over prices together, and they would be sharing tools together, and they would be worrying about the price of goat skins going up dramatically, and they would, all the issues of business and work and struggle and sweat and do we have enough business? Do we have too much business? How's it all going to work out? They did all that together, and they shared their Christian life in that setting. So that they were being Christians together in a working environment where Christ's love could be expressed to the others in the working section of the city, and they could support one another when they were at work, and then they could go home and, you know, rent a movie on the way home and pop some popcorn and, you know, kick back at night because they were staying in the same place. This isn't sort of Christian fellowship that takes place only in Bible studies and only at prayer meetings and only at officially sanctioned religious environments. They shared a lot of their life together, and it must have been a great gift to Paul to have been taken into their home. And this is a wonderful couple who loved each other and loved him. Tent making has become, since the very beginning, but by name, a way of describing Christian missionary service. People who have skills, trades, accountants and teachers and construction workers and people who have a skill they can use can go to a place and get a job and begin to not depend on anybody's gifts, that's not required in this case, but work in a new place and make new friends and serve the Lord doing ministry as tent makers. Let me just, before we move on and talk about the old friends who also care for Paul here, issue a call to us. Today's effectively the first day of summer. It's not obviously the first day of summer, but Memorial Day weekend is basically the kickoff of summer, I think, in most people's sort of living calendar of the year. And my call to you is this summer, before the end of the summer, make a new friend. Put yourself in a setting where the Lord can knit your heart to somebody you didn't know before, where you can see Him through the eyes of somebody that's new and unfamiliar, where you can see yourself more clearly because they see you with new eyes, where you can experience something fresh for the first time. Make a new friend. Let the Lord minister to you through someone else. And put yourself in a new setting, I guess is the other point. Take the skills you have, the opportunities you have, the strengths you have, and offer them to the Lord in a place that's not, again, familiar to you, so that you're reaching out to folks that you don't yet know. And I think it's often we have to push ourselves to get out of the circle that same circle we run around all the time. But it's worth doing, and it's worth seeing what the Lord will do if we make that choice. Well, the body of Christ is offering its ministry to the discouraged man, and the new friends are part of it. I think the old friends are also crucial at this point. Silas and Timothy come from Macedonia. They come with money that's been given by other old friends in Philippi and Thessalonica and in other cities. They come saying, Paul, we love you. We have our absence from your life wasn't because we didn't care. We do care. They care. Our other friends care. Paul, you matter to us, and you have for all this time, and you will for all the time to come. Old friends can speak of your value in the way that no one else can. People that have loved you a long time can love you in ways that are crucial to hear. People that know your old stuff. Remember, the advantage of new friends is they don't know your old stuff. The advantage of old friends is they do know. They do know what you've been like a long time, and they care for you anyway. They can hold you accountable for things. They can see things that about you that you might need to be reminded of, and they know you well enough to be able to do that. But it's a great gift of God to have folks who have walked alongside you a long time and who come be part of building you up when you need building up. And so the Lord, in this case, gave this apostle both new and old friends in the body of Christ to encourage him. What else can we see here as the Lord strengthens a man? Well, there is stuff that gets turned on its head in Corinth, stuff that we've come to expect that comes out differently in the ministry that takes place there. He begins teaching in the synagogue. He teaches more aggressively when his friends come, with more opportunity to do so. And as we expect, we've come to see this, the synagogue leads to both faith and unfaith, to belief and resistance. Those who resist him, in this case, do not get to reject Paul and sort of run him out of town on a rail, because he does the rejecting first. It's a different thing that God allows him to do. Instead of waiting till they throw him out of the synagogue, he finally says to them, I'm done with you. And he walks out and shakes out his garment in protest against them. And he moves on to the building next door and begins to teach the word of God there. And I think it's worth noting that part of telling the gospel story, part of reminding people of what it means to know Christ, is to issue a warning eventually. If you hear the same thing and reject it over and over again, your heart gets hard. And finally, Paul's come to the point where he said, it's time for me to leave you. Because any further throwing of pearls your direction will just result in your trampling upon them. And And so he turns and walks away. Rather than him being the rejectee, he is the rejecter in this case. The high point of the story clearly is the vision. The Lord finally in person coming to Paul in a dream and saying, Paul, I'm not going to let anybody hurt you. Keep on speaking. Now, I think he means for the time you're in Corinth, because he's not saying you'll never again have hard times. And we know that Paul, of course, again did have hard times. But in this case, in this city, in this time, I'm not going to let anybody here hurt you. There are plenty more people who will respond to your message. Your ministry is going to flourish here. I am with you. I myself am your companion. And in all of these ways, the Lord is calming and strengthening and building up the man who was shaky. It's interesting that when the Lord speaks to Paul, he doesn't say, do not be afraid. Some translations have it that way. It's actually, stop being afraid. Which makes the case that Paul was still dealing with some fears and uncertainties of himself. The dream that was given to Paul in Troas when it said, come to Macedonia, has its opposite here. In this dream, Paul is told to stay in the same place. Don't leave. The other case, he was told to leave and travel. In this place, he's told to stay and minister. Finally, I think we see in the recognition that Crispus and Titius Justus both come to Christ, that the Lord was encouraging Paul by converts who were capable and gifted, a leader of the synagogue, a man of means that has a building next door that can be used for ministry. And in these individuals and many others like them, the church was being strengthened. Capable people that wanted and loved to serve God were being presented. I mentioned that Gallio was a good judge. That was another gift God gave to Paul. He'd been before bad judges in previous settings where mobs were allowed to get out of control, not in this case. The Lord lets him come before an honest judge. And finally, the little story of Sosthenes getting beat up can encourage us, I think, and may as well have encouraged Paul when it got to its end. Crispus had been the leader of the synagogue. He converts to Christ, so they got to choose a new leader of the synagogue. They choose Sosthenes. He's the new leader of the synagogue. And he presents the case. He goes before Gallio, and the other members of the synagogue are so ticked that he does such a bad job of advocacy, they take him out and beat him up. Now, Paul's used to being the guy that gets beat up after the trial. I mean, that's kind of his role in life, is to get hammered, you know, after the public trial. And it might have just brought a smile to his face to see, you know, in some kind of peculiar way, to see that, you know, somebody else gets hammered this time. But look at the opening verse of 1 Corinthians, the letter of 1 Corinthians. Listen carefully. Paul's writing, Paul, called as an apostle of Jesus Christ by the will of God, and Sosthenes, our brother, to the church of God which is at Corinth. And Sosthenes getting beat up by the synagogue members had led to him coming to Christ, evidently, and so he's mentioned in Paul's first letter writing to the Corinthians. The Lord is meeting his needs. The Lord is acting on his behalf. The Lord is caring for his servant. We walk by faith, not by sight. Paul had to take the trip from Athens to Corinth. He had to finish it. He had to walk into the city. He had to go where God had called him to go, even though he didn't know how any care for him would be offered. He went there with his shoulders slumped. He went there hungry. He went there broke. He went there alone. He wished it were different. It wasn't different. He went there anyway. Lord, you've got to show up here, or all is lost. But he didn't fail to go. And once he arrived in the city, he realized that the Lord was there ahead of time and had a home for him to stay and people to care for him and all the things we've seen in the ways that the Lord took care of him. The way we grow faith is to trust God when he's not evident. We can't measure, when we can't predict, when we don't know the answer ahead of time. We're going into circumstances we don't know how they're going to turn out. How any good can come of any of this? The last thing I want to say as we close is how important it is that in the city of Corinth, for, for the first time most clearly, the training of the next generation is at the center of what Paul was called to do. He went next door to the synagogue, opened a ministry school in the home of a guy named Titius Justus, and for a year and a half, 18 months, it says, he stayed there and he taught day after day, and people were converted to Christ, and new leadership was emerging, and he taught them and encouraged them and believed in them. The saints are being equipped to do the work of the ministry in this case. And one of the reasons we know that is because there are names given us of converts and those having a role in Corinth that we don't have anywhere in previous settings. In the three churches that were established in Macedonia, in Philippi, Thessalonica, and Berea, only two people are mentioned, Lydia and Jason. Lydia in Philippi, Jason in Thessalonica. There are a great many other folks there, but they're not mentioned by name. In Corinth, we read the names of Aquila and Priscilla, Crispus, Titius Justus, Sosthenes, and even Gallio. And I think the point being made is this. These were the folks that were stepping into the open doors. These were the folks that were in their generation being the next to lead. This long stay in Corinth allowed for other folks to begin to travel and to go and to use the skills they've been given and the instruction they've been given and to pass it on to other people. It becomes the pattern. Ephesus is the next great city. We'll get to that eventually when we return to these messages. And Ephesus, again, has in it a teaching center that becomes a fountain for ministry to its whole region. Paul realized, I think, finally, and realized in the doing of his work that he couldn't go everywhere and be everything, and even his team couldn't get to every place that wanted missionaries to come. They had to give away the ministry. They had to equip the saints, in his phrase from the book of Ephesians, equip the saints to do the work of the ministry. And that's clearly evident here, and I think it's something that encouraged Paul very deeply. He realized that he could give away what he'd been given, and that God would be faithful to use other people in the ministry. We walk by faith, not by sight. We gain faith by trusting God when we can't see, by moving forward even when it's difficult, by assuming He will be there even though there's no measurable evidence that He's here there now. We're going to conclude our morning by singing together. I want to invite our worship leaders to come up to lead us. But as they do, I want to read to you from 2 Corinthians, a letter written by Paul to this church sometime later about being sure of things that are invisible. 2 Corinthians 4:16. Therefore we do not lose heart, but though the outer man is decaying, yet the inner man is being renewed day by day. For momentary, light affliction is producing for us an eternal weight of glory far beyond comparison. While we look not at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporary, but the things which are not seen are eternal. Please stand and we'll sing together.